Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Good evening. Welcome to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for joining us tonight. We have a very exciting show. Tonight we're speaking with Dr. Charles Glassman. He is a medical doctor and a karate black belt, and he's written a book called Brain Drain, The Breakthrough That Will Change Your Life, Simple Steps for Lifelong Success. So welcome to the show, Dr. Glassman.
Thanks for having me, Marie. Thanks for having me, Marie. I appreciate it.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Is it the heat back there that's affecting you tonight?
It's making me a little tongue-tied, I think.
Well, yeah. Thanks for being with us tonight, despite the heat. And so the topic of your book generally is, I just want to simplify it, it's really overcoming those automatic responses and reactions that we have. We live in this society on such a high level of stress all the time. And so I'm wondering, can you tell us what inspired you, first of all, to write this book?
Sure. About 3.5 years ago, a patient came to me and expressed how great he felt after speaking with me, which was, very humbling, and it felt good. But one of the things that he mentioned was that, yeah, it felt great when he was in the office, but then when he went back into his life, things just kind of were in shambles. They just would break apart so quickly, and between office visits in a way. So he asked me if there was anything I could do to help keep him motivated between office visits, and surely it's not. The responsibility for me as a doctor, and I've learned this over the years, is really to be a guide, more of a coach. And what we came up with was the idea of a weekly email. So I began sending him an email, a motivational email, not a medical necessarily email that would address his medical issues, but really motivational ideas that would keep him on track so his lifestyle choices would be more apt to keep him healthy. And so these motivational emails started, and after about two or three of them, and I would do it every Monday morning, that was kind of the set goal that we had. After two or three, I realized, what I was talking about didn't just apply to him, but really to all of my patients and also myself. So this went on for about a year and a half or so, and the emails got longer and longer, and my list got longer and longer. And after that time, a year and a half, also I was in the process of starting an adjunct business to my medical practice, which would be corporate consulting in a wellness area. And after a year and a half, that business, about May of 2008, just didn't seem as though it was going to get off the ground. And during a meditation one day, and we could talk about that later, I do meditate, and it's very important to the concepts in my book. And I was meditating one afternoon, which is unusual for me because I usually meditate in the morning, but circumstances had it, meditating in the afternoon, and this inspiration came to me. And everyone had been saying, oh, you got to write a book, because they liked my emails. But really, I felt as though I had to get this business to increase my audience first, and then I would write the book. And I realized later that was kind of an excuse, because I really did need to write this book mainly for myself. So during my meditation, I got the inspiration, And it came to me, turn your weekly messages into a book. You don't need anybody but yourself, and meditate every day. Those were three very strong messages that came to me during that meditation. And that Monday, this was a Saturday afternoon, that Monday I decided to put out my first installment of my book, which was the introduction. So each week I would write a chapter of my book instead of an email motivational message. It would be a chapter from my book. And during this process, I was looking into myself more than anything, and I would get my ideas and my inspiration for the chapters, and I didn't really have an outline. I would meditate during the week, and during the meditation, I would get my inspiration of how this book would, how it would follow, how the chapters would be laid out, and what I would talk about. And it wasn't called Brain Drain initially. Initially, it was called Ego versus Essence. Okay, and then looking at it, I actually had an agent who picked it up, and then later dropped me, and then I had some times for introspection and thinking about it. And then I added, after I got dropped from the agent, my first agent, I decided to add a third section to the book, which is called 7 Days to Belief, because my feeling was, if I didn't believe 100% in what I was writing about, who would believe in me? And who would believe in the message? And who would really be able to take these words and help it help themselves? And so I needed to do that to kind of put it all together in that final section of the book. And I later came up with the name Brain Drain, which was another inspiration. And you know, the breakthrough that will change your life, of course, you know, family and friends will chuckle and, you know, say, oh, you know, the breakthrough, it sounds like a little grandiose, you know, the breakthrough that will change your life. But it really, I feel it has changed my life, you know, just writing this book. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from readers, and they say that it really, they feel that a lot of the concepts that I cover, has helped them out a lot.
And you won an award for this book, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah. This is the when you decide to do these kind of projects on your own and take on this, and that idea that I got, that inspiration 2 years ago, you don't need anybody but yourself. What that means is, it doesn't mean that you're on an island and you're in a vacuum, but it means that you can be the quarterback. You can be your director. And so I decided to do everything myself. I decided to, I had hired an editor already who had been editing it all along. I found a graphic designer to lay out the book. I found a printer. I got all the appropriate copyrights and ISBN numbers and all that. And so I put out this product, and then I submitted it to different book festivals. And I was acknowledged at the New England Book Festival for honorary mention in the nonfiction category. The winner in that category actually was a Pulitzer Prize winner in the past. I won at the Los Angeles Film Festival. I actually won in the spirituality category, which was a really, you know, I felt that they got it. You know, if I won in the spirituality category, they got my book. They understood it. I also won the Pinnacle Achievement Award for the new North American Book Exchange as a best self-help book, and I won also an Eric Hoffer Award. I was an Eric Hoffer finalist in their best book categories in 2010. So it really, it's just so affirming that what I'm writing about does resonate. Even though I wrote this book really looking into myself and was inspired through my own meditation and my own inner guidance, I know it resonates not only with me, but with my readers and even objective judges, if you will, you know, looking at it objectively as a literary book, you know, as a literary work of art, let's say, if that's not too out there.
Awesome. Well, I'm really glad that you wrote this book, and it does sound like it's helping a lot of people. And I want to get into the meat of the book. Now, one of the things that stood out for me the most is that with our automatic brain, when we get into that fight or flight mode, our hormones and adrenaline and cortisol and all of that starts pumping. And we know that cortisol creates, helps us to store fat around our stomach and things like that.
Yep.
But there's another thing about that happens in our blood with these hormones. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And I'm just going to trace it back a little bit now to 50,000, 100,000, 250,000 years ago. And we have this protective brain, which some people know as the autonomic nervous system, the limbic system is part of that. And it's an automatic system. I've termed automatic brain because it's much more than that. But this automatic brain, its only purpose, and one of the reasons why we have survived as a Homo sapiens species, and this brain even predates that, reptilian brain and all that goes into it, but one of the reasons why we have survived as a species is because this brain only responds to danger, threat, or vulnerability. Anything in the environment where that is detected, this is going to flash. It's going to go off. And 50,000, 100,000, 250,000 years ago, there were very distinct dangers or threats. And those, what would happen is when that was faced, when we experienced it, it would, the trigger would go off. And the trigger, the dangers were pretty universal and pretty much the same for everybody. Nowadays, which we'll talk about later, the dangers are different. But then the dangers were pretty much universal, and it was either environmental or predatory or something of that nature. So when that would happen, the trigger would go off, and we would either fight or flee danger. So what would happen now if we are in an environment and we're running for our lives, and all of a sudden, you know, we get slashed and we're bleeding? So what happens when that occurs is that this automatically, that system kicks in, and it causes the release of hormones, which causes vasoconstriction, meaning the narrowing of arteries, and it also causes the blood to clot, because we didn't have paramedics then. Okay, we didn't have 4x4 Johnson & Johnson 4x4 gauze. Okay, we didn't have any of that stuff. So our body knew that, but you know something? We do have that now. But our body does the same thing now. Even if it's as though we're cutting ourselves every day, it's as though we're running into, a sharp edge of a rock and slicing, because it's the same reaction. The reaction is generic, but we don't need it anymore. It's obsolete. But that automatic response, whether it's a physiologic response, whether it's the feeling we get when we see a police officer in our rearview mirror and our heart starts pounding, or if somebody calls upon us in a crowded room to give an answer to a question, or we're startled, or we do get physically hurt, or we're in physical confrontation, we all know that physiologic response. And it makes our heart race, it makes us breathe more shallow, it makes our muscles tighten, and what you can't see is it also causes your blood vessels to constrict, and it also causes your blood to clot more efficiently, even though you don't need that. So that is part of the physiologic reaction, which you're talking about, Marie. That's a very distinct, and we take that from hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, but it hasn't changed. It remains the same, but we don't really need it anymore. It'll be there if we do, if we're in an unfortunate situation, as I talk about in my book about one of my patients, Archie, who was a young 18-year-old in World War II, and when he was shot by crossfire after being ejected from his tank in the invasion of France, you know, he wanted that automatic system to kick in, and it will, but we don't need it 24/7, and it's always on 24/7.
And so, and I'm wondering, because back 100,000 years ago, we didn't have the same type of constant stress all the time. I mean, we'd be picking berries or doing whatever we would do, and then a tiger or whatever would come, and we would run or fight it.
Yeah.
But the way it is now, we have these triggers all of the time. Someone cuts us off in traffic, someone, our boss yells at us, all of those things. And but why is it that, I mean, maybe someone cutting us off in traffic, that's a little bit dangerous, but someone asking us to answer a question in front of a room full of people,
It's
not really that dangerous. So why is it that our bodies and our brains interpret these signals all day long to be so dangerous?
Yes, well, it's a great question, and what it really comes down to is breaking it down, okay, and looking at this. See, we look at our ancestors, and we think even our ancestors, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the Bible and that sort of thing, because we look at that, you know, 2,000 years ago, 3,000, 50,000, as though that somehow they were different than we are. But their brains were exactly, or very much, very, very similar to us. Okay, so that's one of the concepts that I'd like to point out. But when getting back to, you know, why do we think things are dangerous? Think about this now. Think about an infant and the brain and brain development. Brain development occurs mostly between the ages of birth and 12 years old. So during that time, our brain is, the neurons are being put together. They're being assembled. So really, if you think about what a child views as dangerous and what an adult views as dangerous are very different. Yet as adults, we respond like a child. And there are many, you know, people who have talked about you know, the child, the inner child, and that sort of thing. John Bradshaw talks about that and has written about that and really has pointed that out. What I talk about is the idea that our brain is being put together, is being assembled, is learning what I call danger memories, okay, that are being ingrained, giving us the automatic brain is being assembled to know what we need to view as what's dangerous, threatening, or vulnerable. So, for instance, let's say your brain is being, let me put it this way. There are several concepts also during development. One is the idea of leaving the nest. Many of us, when we leave our comfort zone, when we leave things and we challenge ourselves, it's so uncomfortable that we have to retreat. We have to flee. That's a danger. So if you view, and that's a universal danger from just about everybody when they do that, and that's because, let's say you're a five-year-old child. You rely on your home. You rely on your nest. That's your protection. Anything outside of that close nest, that protective barriers of the four walls in your home and whatever, whether you have a functional or dysfunctional family, it doesn't matter. You are there, okay? You are safe. And when you venture out, so your brain at that time is being put together, is being formulated, so it's being connected that as an adult, a danger trigger may occur when you go out, when you leave the nest, when you leave that security. Another kind of thing that we think about with danger memories that I think about is what if, for instance, the idea of love also, when you withdraw love from a child or a primate, there have been studies done, if you take love away from a primate, they'll wither away and die. And similarly, if you take love away from a child, they will not thrive. So the automatic brain has this love receptor, so to speak. So it's on guard. It needs love. And if there are certain requirements for that love, so for instance, let's say you're kind of an aloof kid, and nothing bothers you, and you don't worry. Yet your mother, your father, your grandmother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, they're all worriers. They're always worrying about everything. And you're just a happy-go-lucky kid, 6 years old, 7 years old, go out on your bike. You don't, you know, care about anything. You're carefree. And all of a sudden, you see your family is kind of saying, you know, what's wrong with you? You don't worry about this? You know, and and love is almost withdrawn from that child. So when the child is an adult now, not worrying is somehow a danger trigger. The person doesn't know why. And I talk about actually an example in my book with a woman who actually experienced this. So there are things that as this brain is being developed, so we have some primitive reflexes that are or the startle, like a startle reflex. Those are ingrained. Those are genetic. Those are for hundreds of thousands of years. But then we also have these danger memories which follow us into adulthood but come from this childish brain that was connected between birth and 12 years old. So that's where we really learn what we're going to feel is dangerous, threatening, or vulnerable. So embarrassment, for instance, you know, being one-upped by somebody, those are all, we call them instincts, but they're really learned dangers. And that's one of the things that will trigger and as I said before, the dangers nowadays are different for everybody, but the reaction is still the same. It's universal. It's either fight or flight. And so we fight or flee in different ways. We may fight or flee by the fight being that person cutting you off on the road is aggressive, is angry, is rageful. Anytime there's behavior like that, there is some danger trigger behind it. You know, whether the person feels they're being one-upped or they have trouble at home or whatever, it's a danger. And similarly, the flight, being depressed, being sad all the time, being being withdrawn. That's the flight, and whenever that's present, it's always attached to some danger trigger, whether it's a danger memory from childhood or whether it's a obvious contemporary common day danger that you might be experiencing. But most of the time, as you mentioned, they're not real dangers.
So Charles, that leads me to question, after you've gone through the steps in your book and
yeah,
all of us or whatever route you choose to better yourself and to free yourself from these automatic responses,
yes,
are you still going to have that instant of being really irked when someone cuts you off, and then it's that you make a choice to let it bother you or not, or do those reactions dissipate a bit?
Mm-hmm. Certain reactions do dissipate. The ones that are drawn, that are really, the anger, the rage, let's say the polarity of the responses, those do ease a lot. What I would say, though, is that we're not going to be able to do anything about hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. Okay, we have a primitive brain within us. It's in us. It's operating all the time. It's going to always operate. And it's our decision not to believe it, not to trust it. It's our choice not to believe, trust, or take direction from it. So if that person cuts you off and you get an instant surge of adrenaline, you breathe and you say there's no danger, there's no threat. It's up to you whether you're going to follow that instinct, you know, whether you're going to follow that automatic reaction. And I use the example of In a Beautiful Mind, with the story of John Forbes Nash that Russell Crowe played. At the end of that film, Russell Crowe is walking across the green at Princeton. And as he's walking, he's free now. He's 75 years old. He's overcome his battle with schizophrenia. However, his delusions are still following him. So the little girl, his best buddy from college, the CIA agent, they're alongside of him. They're chatting it up. But he's not believing, trusting, or taking direction from what they're saying. So the key is, that is the fundamental point that I would, you know, that I make for myself and what I've decided to, you know, to do, to move in the opposite direction. So those automatic brain responses are something that I feel we're better suited when they're triggered. We need to do the opposite. So when it's triggered, when someone cuts you off and you get that urge, oh, I gotta, you know, one up that person, you know that that's the one up trigger. You know that that person isn't, there's no danger, there's no threat. So that's an affirmation that you could say. It's a it, you know it's a it's a you know, it's a breath that you take and you step back. But what I'm really interested in, because people will say, ask me all the time, and I'm sure you experience this, I've experienced this, when you try to relax or when you really try to meditate or try to do things that are mindful, are more mindful, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, it seems as though these intrusions seem to come more, and they're relentless. And, you know, one of the ways that I've, you know, thought about this, that these are where the thoughts come from. We all wonder, you know, why do I get these thoughts? And I've wondered that when I was training in the martial arts years ago, when I was in a yoga class, you know, a couple years ago, when I'm meditating, you know, why do these intrusions come? Where do they come from? And I feel that I have come across this idea of the automatic brain as the etiology or the source of these thoughts. So these thoughts, if you're putting yourself in a position that is vulnerable, sitting down and meditating, this, remember, this is the same brain 50,000 years ago, the same brain as a child. You're sitting quietly in a quiet space. That brain is going to pick up vulnerability. So it's going to do whatever it takes, by all means necessary, to make you fight or flee that vulnerable position. Because if you're in a cave 50,000 years ago, sitting and meditating, I got news for you, that's pretty vulnerable, okay? Or if you're a little baby, a little child, sitting with your eyes closed in a dark room, it's kind of vulnerable. You feel vulnerable. You feel afraid. And it's going to trigger that fight or flight. So the thoughts that come in, you don't believe, trust, or take direction from. You can almost laugh at them, but you make sure that you breathe, because that fight or flight will make your breath more shallow. It'll make your muscles tighten. So even though those thoughts may still be there, even though the automatic response may be there, it gets less and less, but it will surprise you. It will come out of the blue sometimes. And even though you could be the most mindful person, and it will still be there. And that's because you are not going to change 250,000 years of evolution. However, what I believe is that we do have a higher mind, and that came into existence, what I believe, around the time of biblical creation. And I can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, let's. Well, okay. It looks like we have a question on the line.
Okay.
So how about we talk about the biblical creation? I'm just going to make a note of it.
Okay.
And then we'll take this caller. It looks like they're calling from Skype. So you are on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Excuse me. My name is Sharon. I was just wondering, when your body, if you have constant stress for a while, say many months or even longer, does that reset your fight-or-flight response? Does it make it faster?
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, does it make it respond quicker than it normally should? And should you try to reset, you know, get it to reset back to work?
Shannon, that's a really great question. And, you know, just to kind of put this all in perspective, now, I'm a doctor, okay,
right.
And a medical doctor, yet, you know, so a lot of people, you know, they'll from the outside, they'll look at me and, you know, I always say that, you know, you can't compare your internal reality compared to someone's external reality. So people see me as a doctor and they say, oh, this guy can't be, you know, nervous, can't be, get stressed, whatever, can't, you know, whatever. I'm not saying you feel it, but other people have looked at me and felt that way. Yet everything I write about and talk about, I write about from my own personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this firsthand, and I've
mm-hmm.
experienced all these things. And what you're asking is a great point, because there have been times in my life where you kind of get this overwhelm where it seems like as though everything is causing this discharge. And what that is basically And it seems as though you don't have control over it. And in some respects, you don't have control over the automatic brain because it's going to go on autopilot. It's going to be operating 24/7. It's always looking. Okay, it's always looking for danger. It's not just reacting to it. It's actually actively looking, and it's going to default to the worst-case scenario if you believe it, if you trust it, and if you take direction from it. It's not going to change at all, okay? All it's going to do, it depends on your belief, your trust, and whether you take direction. So when we feel stressed and then another thing happens, it seems as though it seems as though we're more sensitive to it, but really it hasn't changed. It just means that we're trusting it more. And so it's kind of an example I like to use is it's like an overprotective parent. And an overprotective parent is going to tell you, Sharon, well, you know, Sharon, you have to wear your raincoat every single day of the year because you know why? It may rain.
Right.
And guess what?
Mm.
That overprotective parent will be right probably a third of the time, or if you live in Seattle, maybe, you know, two-thirds of the time or whatever. But are you going to believe, trust, or take direction from that overprotective parent? Well, as a child, you have no choice, and that's where a lot of the danger memories get, you know, ingrained and then, you know, taken to adulthood. But as an adult, you look at your situations and you decide, am I going to believe, trust, or take direction from, you know, me going forward, me going out of my comfort zone, or me dealing with this particular stress or this particular person? Does this person really pose a danger to me? And you take a step back. And one of the things that I would, you know, suggest is also when this overwhelming stuff occurs, we tend to end up feeding it more. So it seems as though we're more sensitive to it. So instead of tuning into music or humor, we end up watching the news more. Okay? Mm-hmm. Or instead of eating healthy, more healthfully, we start turning to fats and sugars because that feeds this automatic response. And so those kind of things, by feeding it, actually makes it seem as though the barometer has been set differently, or the thermostat has been lowered in a way, and we're more reactive. The floodgates open up more readily, and that's just because we're believing, trusting, and taking direction from it more. At least in my view, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense at all?
Yes, it does. It does.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's really good that you pointed out that, yeah, we do. When we're under that, we do tend to eat fast food.
Yeah.
And take shortcuts when it's better to do the meditation and better to, you know, buy the fresh fruits and vegetables that take a little bit more time.
Yeah.
To prepare, right? Mhm.
And take
well,
and
wonderful
take,
question, Sharon.
Yeah,
thank
take
you so much
and
for
take time
in.
For yourself, because this automatic brain is going to tell you, you know, no, you don't have time. You have to deal with that, you know, you have to pay that bill right now. You know, if you don't pay it right now, you're going to go into your house, going to go into foreclosure, and you're going to be out on the street. You better pay it now. You don't have time to meditate. You don't have time to eat, you know, take your time eating. You got to, you know, watch the news. You got to know what's happening everywhere in the world, because if you don't know, then, you know, you might get, you know, it's just, it seems as though it you're more sensitive to it, but really it's just believing and trusting it more.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you brought that up. How long has the book been out?
It's been out since November, so about 8 months now. It's available on Amazon if you're interested in it.
Yeah, I'm on there now looking at it. So, yeah, I mean, it seems really interesting. I'll get me a copy. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Sure, and if you want, also, my website, you can get the two chapters of it for, you know, if you wanted to sample it and see what it's about and sign up for my weekly message, too. So, anyway.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Doctor, thank you so much.
Okay,
have
sure.
a great week.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that was such an excellent question, and it brought up, because she was asking about when you are overly stressed, do you kind of get to the point where everything stresses you out that much more? And that kind of makes me think of one of our Namaste authors, David Berselli, he has a book mm-hmm. called The Revolutionary Trauma Release Process. Mm-hmm. And that's for specifically for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the things with PTSD, one of the symptoms, is hypervigilance, which is mm-hmm. that state of, like you said, how your automatic brain is always looking for something, the worst-case scenario that's going to happen. And when yeah. you have PTSD, it's even more heightened than the average person.
Sure.
And so, like our caller was asking, do you have any tricks for lowering that? Because sometimes I think when you get, I understand what you're saying about
yes.
not trusting and believing, but sometimes
yes.
you get so caught up in this, like, crap wheel.
Yeah, sure.
that it's like hard to recognize what's really happening. You get your thoughts run away with you. So do you have any tips for people who are maybe just getting started?
Yes, absolutely. You know, really what is the thing that really gets us the most is the physiologic feeling. And that's kind of sets the tone for everything. So when there's a danger or you perceived a real danger and it's triggered and you feel this fight or flight response, and it may not be, it just may be just a sense of discomfort and tremulousness or anxiety inside or just discomfort. You just don't feel right. Your head is a little cloudy and you just don't feel right. So that's the first thing that happens. It's usually the physical response first, and then the thoughts start kicking in, especially when someone has a panic attack or anxiety. It's the physical response first, and then all of a sudden they feel as though they're having a heart attack or whatever, and then it just goes racing. So the first thing is to counter the physiologic response. And when I say don't believe, trust, or take direction, so this physiologic response is automatically telling you to have a rapid heartbeat, to breathe faster and more shallow, and to tighten up your muscles. So the first thing is always to breathe. In through the nose, hold it for a second, out through the nose or mouth. And for people who aren't used to breathing, okay, it sounds kind of funny, but people who aren't used to breathing, they can do what's called box breathing. They can breathe in for a count of four and out for a count of four. When you get used to it, the exhale is actually better for you. So, because it's more cleansing, and you can breathe with affirmation. So as you're breathing in, you know, there's no danger, there is no threat. And as you're breathing out, I am in control of my destiny, I am in control of my life, I love my journey, I love my life, whatever. The affirmations, the self-talk is very important. So the breathing and visualizing yourself as being relaxed. Now, a lot of people will say, okay, well, is that going to take care of my bills? Is that going to pay my bills? Is that going to... But see, that's the automatic brain kicking in. When you take a step back and you take control of the physiologic response, and even though it's going on, I can tell you this, adrenaline only lasts in the body about 2 minutes. It has a very short half-life. Half-life means the time it takes for the amount to be cut in half, meaning your body metabolizes it. So the adrenaline is the most visible hormone that we can't really feel cortisol that much, but we can feel adrenaline. And adrenaline will only last a couple minutes unless you feed it, with the thoughts of, oh, my God, this means I'm having a heart attack, I'm going to die. This means I'm out of control. I don't have control. I'm out of control. I can't control anything in my life. Oh, I'm a failure. I can't control anything because I get nervous when the doctor comes and tries to take my blood pressure. Well, if you read my book, I got news for the reader, you know, who hasn't read my book. I talk about that in my book because that happened to me. All of a sudden, when I was a second-year medical student, I got white coat syndrome. So, you know, doctor comes up to me, my heart races, whatever. It's an irrational fear. And so that, all of a sudden, I started feeling, oh, my God, I don't have control. I'm losing control. What does that mean? You know, and that, you know, those are the kind of things that what you can do is, if you don't believe, trust, and just keep moving ahead, as I've done, doesn't stand in my way, and honestly, to this day, if it's someone tries to take my blood pressure, I still, it's an automatic response, but it doesn't prevent me from doing anything. It doesn't prevent me from having a physical. It doesn't prevent me from, because I'm not, I don't let it embarrass me. I don't feel as though I'm in any danger. And that's the key. I breathe and I don't trust it. So breathing is for someone who's not that experienced in taking control, the first step is the breath, taking a step back, saying there is no danger, there is no threat, I love my life, I love my journey, I will always find a way will always find me. Finding those positive affirmations to integrate into what you do in your daily life, whether you're driving in your car or whether you're interacting with people at work or whether you're meditating. You know, it's important to just don't believe and trust always that physiologic response, because that is really the thing that sets the whole ball in motion.
Wonderful.
You know, there's also, I talk about a revelation grid in my book, which is actually a physical method that one can do to actually see when the brain is, is active as opposed to the mind, which, you know, now I'll talk about a little bit.
Is that the revelation grid?
Yeah, well, together with the mind. See, the revelation grid that I talk about in my book, actually, I call it a revelation grid because it really reveals our blocking thoughts, what's real, and what we really, truly want in our lives that is good and most consistent with our strengths and most consistent with our true life experience as people on Earth. You know, that revelation grid I talk about points out what is mind versus brain. And our mind, as I mentioned before, that allows us to step back. Our mind is what is consciousness. Our mind is our connection, is our portal to our spirituality, our portal to God, if you will, our portal to our true, pure potential. Even if you don't believe in a God or a superior energy force or whatever, it's our connection with our soul, with our spirit, with our true potential. So our mind had really, something happened in the evolution of humankind around the time of biblical creation. And what happened was we became farmers, an agricultural society from a hunter and gatherer society in a very short span of time, which took some development, some mindfulness. And that mindfulness, I believe, is what really we need to tap into to return back to nirvana of the garden, if you will, as a, you know, the Garden of Eden as an allegory or as a story, as where we, as humans, as Adam and Eve, let's say, followed their automatic brain, and they were discharged or dispatched from Eden because they didn't trust that new mind that came into being somehow. And they followed their primitive brain, their automatic brain, they believed, trusted, and took direction right out of Eden. And I feel it's our life journey to try to return back to that nirvana through our mind. And I talk about this revelation grid is because even in certain circumstances in our life, certain instances, let's say, for instance, you want to change your job, okay? And so you put on the left hand side, you put, you know, staying the same and not changing your job, and then underneath it you put changing your job, and then on top you put the danger, and then on the next column you label that safety or comfort. So in the box that's labeled changing your job, what would be the danger of changing your job? And when you write down all those things, that is your automatic brain coming in. That's like when I did a revelation grid for writing my book. What would be the dangers for me writing my book? Well, the dangers for me writing my book would be, you know, making myself vulnerable, exposing inner thoughts. Maybe, you know, people wouldn't want to hang around. You know, friends would alienate me because, you know, they think I'm too heady or I'm going to be, you know, analyzing them or something. So I'd lose my friends, okay? So that was one, you know, or, you know, people will learn that I didn't go to Harvard or Yale because it seems like all these authors and all these, you know, people with a lot of notoriety, you know, seem to have gone to Ivy League schools or whatever. Or I would, maybe I'll make money from the book and, and I'll turn away people who aren't making as much money and they won't want to be my friends anymore or whatever. Okay, so, you know, these are things. There was a bunch of other, believe me, that was the longest, you know, entry in my revelation grid. And then you'd go to what is the comfort and safety of staying the same? Well, the comfort and safety of and not writing a book. Well, the comfort and safety of not writing a book is, you know, I'm not exposing myself to a larger audience. I'm already successful locally. I don't have to open myself up to a larger audience, you know, and you know, these kind of things. And that's the way the brain works. Okay, the brain, whether I decided to write a book or didn't decide to write a book, there's going to be dangers associated or false sense of security. So the danger of staying the same would not be realizing my true potential, not moving ahead with my life, you know, not doing something that I'm passionate about, that I feel I can help people about. You know, that would be the danger. But what would be the comfort and safety of writing the book? And the comfort and safety of writing my book would be just endless. Okay, there's just so many positives and so many, which is more consistent and more mindful and more true to myself. And so when you put it down on paper, and you know, some people do that in the form of pros and cons when they're, you know, want to change their job, let's say. But if you put it in the box in the revelation grid, as I talk about in my book, you really see it. And I talk about this gentleman in my book who actually moved forward with his career and got his dream job because we pointed out what was blocking him, that it was really his automatic brain. And by doing certain techniques, not feeding his automatic brain, but freeing up and cultivating his mind, he was able to move forward. And you know, that's tapping in and cultivating your mind is the single greatest thing you can do to calming the automatic brain and touching your and connecting with that portal, you know, your conduit to your deeper self, really.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing the revelation grid. That's awesome. And if people want to, you mentioned to our caller earlier that
yes,
you can get a couple of free chapters on your website. So your website is charlesglassmanmd.com, correct?
Yes, correct. Yes.
Great. And there's also a link to that on the Blog Talk Radio page for this show, as well as a link to your book on Amazon.com. So that's charlesglassmanmd.com. And I want to talk about the 7 days to belief, but before we get into that,
yes,
I mentioned it in the introduction, in the little blurb I wrote for the show, about smoking. And so I'm curious what
yes,
your theory is on why people smoke cigarettes.
Yes. You know, I talk a lot about breathing, and every discipline that talks about relaxation always mentions breathing. And it seems as though it's something that we all know about, and it almost seems trite, but we don't really breathe, because true breathing in through your nose, out through your mouth or your nose, is a way to slow down that automatic response. And cigarette smokers, and I noticed this because, you know, my parents at one time smoked, and I've noticed it in patients and observing other smokers. I personally have never smoked, but observing smokers, I noticed that they pick up cigarettes when things are hectic and they're rushing around, whatever, and all of a sudden, they take that deep sucking in and hold it and then blow it out. And what they're doing is exactly what I'm educating people to do, is to counter that physiologic response. You do the opposite. So the physiologic response when you're stressed, what the adrenaline and cortisol makes you do is breathe more rapidly and more shallow. And so what they're doing is what I'm telling you to do, but I'm not telling you to put smoke in front of you and suck it in. I'm telling you to breathe the air in front of you. But what they're doing, they're simulating that. And so it's the actual motion, the inhaling motion, that is very relaxing. But, you know, there is obviously a chemical dependence of some sort with cigarettes. But it is, I would say, it rivals the chemical dependence is the breathing dependent, the need for breath, the need for slowing things down. And that's something which I have educated smokers and helped them to quit by doing that. If they have something that they feel as though they have to put in their mouth, whatever, as long as they breathe when they're stressed and they slow things down and they take that breath, that in and of itself sends a signal that maybe there isn't really danger. Because the physiologic response, getting back to the caller, what she was saying is, does it seem to reset itself? It doesn't really reset itself, but it actually reinforces itself. So the more it's going, the more it signals danger. And the more it goes, the more it signals danger. But the breath somehow short-circuits that. So smokers, without really knowing it, they're practicing mindful breathing, although it's not really, I shouldn't say mindful breathing, maybe unmindful breathing, because they're breathing in toxins. But their physical body is actually sending a signal and trying to relax them, and it obviously does.
And so what about, you also have mentioned in your book the automatic brain and people with weight problems.
Yes, yeah. Well, the cortisol, as you mentioned, is a hormone, and that is secreted, that's put out by the brain when there is that fight or flight, and certainly that stores fat. But probably more insidious than that is going back to what I talked about with danger memories. And a lot of danger memories are put together when we're children, as children, because it's more of the culture of the household. So, for instance, let's say you're in a put to rest the idea of genetics and environment, because many people who are overweight, there is some genetic component, but truthfully, the maximum genetic component is about 35%, meaning there's 65% that's environmental. And of that 35%, that can actually be lowered through what's called epigenetics, through lifestyle choices and that. So I want to, just put a little bit of an asterisk to what I'm going to talk about now, because let's say you're a child and you're in a home that is, everyone in the home is overweight or obese, and you're a thin child. Well, you learn early on that to fit in, to get the love, to get the affection from your family, you need to be like your family, because that it's a danger not to get love. So in order to maintain that, you fit into the culture of the family. So if you're a child and you're thin, and your mother or father says, "Come on, what are you? You're as thin as rails, okay? You're as thin as a rail. You got to eat, okay? And you got to be like all of us, basically." So that's one thing. The idea, so when you're an adult, fast forward 30 years, and you want to lose weight, and all of a sudden, as you start losing weight, you get these danger triggers that go off. Danger, you don't really know why, but it's telling you to fight or flee the danger of being thin. So whenever we have a habit that we want to break, and we can't seem to break it, there's always a danger of breaking the habit. That breaking the habit, it means that it's dangerous. And it comes from a danger memory. Or some of my patients, when they start losing weight, they're afraid they have cancer now. So they say, "Oh my God, I'm losing weight. I must have cancer." So they gain the weight back, and so now they're too fat. And now they say, "Oh my God, I'm going to have a heart attack." So they start losing weight again, and then they lose weight and they say, "Oh my God, I'm going to get cancer." That's all automatic brain stuff. They're danger, false dangers, And one of my patients who was a child, and her grandmother said, well, she had pneumonia. She had pneumonia as an 8-year-old, and her grandmother said, "Well, if you don't eat, you're going to die," because she had lost 8 pounds. So now she's 50 years old, and every time she starts to lose weight, trigger goes off: if I lose weight, I'm going to die. So it's acknowledging that this automatic brain has been formulated with these danger memories. So a lot of overweight and obese has to do with the culture of the family. And a danger memory that's been laid down early on, or it's due to false dangers, like the fear that you have cancer or whatever. And again, go back to the overprotective parent. Some of the time, the overprotective parent may be right. You know, sometimes maybe, you know, some people who do lose weight, you know, it does mean that, but not when you're purposely doing it and following a healthy regimen. Doesn't mean you're sick. You're actually healthier. So you have to be careful not to let it, as it does, the automatic brain, it always defaults to the worst-case scenario. And that worst-case scenario is what keeps triggering things. So so weight is a very big culprit. And so not only does it trigger, but when it triggers, it releases those hormones, which stores the fat and, you know, causes the whole cycle to continue going.
Well, thank you for clearing that up for us, and I'm sure that you have more information about that and tips for people who are dealing with weight issues in your book.
Yes, I sure do.
And so we just have a few minutes left in the show, Dr. Glassman. I've extended it a little bit so that we don't cut off at the very end, but I wanted to quickly go over your 7 days to belief, because this is what you added to your book to make it the brain drain, the breakthrough that will change your life.
Yes, yeah. You know, when I, had this, I had an agent, and my agent who picked me up was a very big agent. Actually, Eckhart Tolle's agent was my agent, Bill Gladstone at one time. And he took my book and pitched it to a few different publishers, and they did not pick it up. Then he said, well, you know, it's a tough industry. I wish you the best of luck. And he, you know, basically we broke our, our relationship mutually, you know. So at that point, I felt I needed to complete my book because I was starting, my automatic brain was starting to kick in and I was starting to have self-doubt. And so I was meditating, and as I sat in my meditation, my inner guide came to me with a question, and the question was, what do you really want? And my answer was, I want to have my book published. And all of a sudden, when I had that answer, I developed a muscle spasm that jolted me out of my meditation, very severe, that I'd never had before. And then I massaged it. It was better. I went back into my meditation. The same question came to me, and my answer was, I just want to believe. I want to believe 100%. I want to believe 100% in my inner guide. I want to believe 100% in my mind as the portal to my spirituality, to God, to my inner power, my pure potential. I want to believe. I want to believe 100%. And that's what prompted me to write 7 Days to Belief. How does one do that? How does one maintain that belief despite everything, all the odds and all the thoughts, all the negative thoughts and all the despite the rain every day, whatever, you know, how do you believe it? How do you maintain and hold on to it? So my plan was laid out as I do it. And I talk about meditation and how I do that on a daily basis. I talk about judgment and how when we look at someone, our judgment of somebody else always has to do with our automatic brain defaulting to having to one-up somebody. I talk about not tuning into the news, so not to feed that, the negative sound bites that we always hear where, you know, now July 4th, we had the Coney Island hot dog eating contest. You know, it was sandwiched in between, you know, a double homicide and, you know, the Gulf tragedy or whatever. You know, it becomes elevator music, you know, modern day elevator music. It means nothing. It desensitizes us, so it doesn't help tap into our mind. I talk about breathing and how we need to continue that breath, but you know, and making our own revelation grid and looking at that. So I do this in a 7-day period, so one can do this. And it doesn't have to be 7 days. You know, I put out these chapters every week. I put out a new chapter every week. And in fact, when people buy my book, in the front of the book, they'll see, I say, look, we're all very busy. Just read a chapter a week. And so it's just a guide. There is no our mind is non-judgmental. It doesn't put requirements, prerequisites on anything we do. That's our automatic brain. So however you decide to take this and integrate it into your life, it's all okay. It's all fine. Whatever works for you, whatever is right for you, is what you should be doing. And my 7 days to belief is what I feel culminates the, it rounds out the book. It allowed me to really finish the book, because that is the main piece. It's about belief. It's about faith. It's about trust and belief in yourself, in your inner guide, in your true potential, in your pure potentiality, in your connection with the energy that's around us. And again, I write this from my personal experience. And yes, you know, I'm a medical doctor, I'm a scientist, if you will, but this is what I've observed in my life and those people who mean so much to me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Glassman, for being on the show. I'm wondering if there's anything. I want to put out your website again. It's charlesglassmanmd.com. There's also a link to that on the Blog Talk Radio page. And before we
I do
talk
have
a little,
also an internet radio show now.
Yeah, I was going to say, before we go into your Coach MD radio show, is there anything that you would like to add about the book or about the reptilian brain that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah, you know, it's really the distinction that we all, every single one of us, every human being possesses a brain and a mind. We're all capable of connecting with our mind, which connects us with our greater energy, greater source. Now, we all have this brain also. From the the people who you look to, who you think are the greatest, who are much more superior than you are, who have so many more things than you have, who seem to be successful in life more than you are, they possess an automatic brain just like your automatic brain. They have dangers and threats and vulnerabilities just like you have dangers and threats and vulnerabilities. They also possess a mind just as you possess a mind. And believing, trusting, and taking direction from your mind rather than your automatic brain will really get you what is right for you in life, what is right for you, not what's right for somebody else, but is right, what is right for you.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much. And so can you tell us about your Coach MD show and your service that you have through your website?
Sure. Yeah, on spiritquestradio.com, spiritquestradio.com on Thursdays at 7 o'clock, I have a radio show where I do interview guests, but I also encourage people to call in with any type of issue they'd like to talk about, because really I look at myself as a coach and an MD. I am an MD, but I do a lot of personal coaching vis-a-vis my book, you know, and the concepts that I've discovered, the things I've discovered in myself and through talking with people over the years. And I feel as though that's what describes me as a Coach MD. So I've also developed a service where I open that up to people throughout the United States and internationally if they either have a medical, if they need some medical information and want to talk to me, a live physician, or if they have a question about a medication. I don't give advice or tell them what to do. I'll give them information about that. But if they want to talk about in more detail about brain drain and how it applies to their life and what they can do with certain situations that seem to be keeping them stuck or in positions that they really feel that they don't, that aren't right for them, I certainly would love to talk with them about that. And those, that link is on my website to my Coach MD service.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show, Dr. Glassman.
Thanks for having me, Maria. It's great talking with you again. Really
wonderful. And again, that's charlesglassmanmd.com.
Yep.
Okay, have a great night.
Great. Thanks again, Marie.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye. So that was Dr. Charles Glassman, MD. He is the author of Brain Drain, The Breakthrough That Will Change Your Life, Simple Steps for Lifelong Success, Again, you can find him at charlesglassmanmd.com. And he has links to a couple of free chapters of his book, as well as his Coach MD service and his Coach MD radio show. And he also recently put out a video for that Oprah Get Your Own Show on the OWN network. So wish him luck with that. He's also entered that contest. And so thank you so much for listening tonight. Tomorrow morning, now usually the show airs Thursdays at 7 p.m., but tomorrow morning at 11 a.m., that's Wednesday, July 7th, at 11 a.m. Pacific time, we have a very special guest on Namaste Radio. It is the Canadian singer-songwriter, Grammy-winning singer-songwriter, Alana Miles, and she is going to be talking about her spirituality, her views on spirituality, the music industry, and how that's kind of shaped her life and maybe perhaps changed her views on spirituality, as well as her latest album that has just recently been released. So please join us tomorrow at 11 a.m. for that interview with Alana Miles. And then next week we will be speaking, next Tuesday we will be speaking with Mimi Kirk. She is the PETA's sexiest woman over 50, and she's actually over 70, and she's still gorgeous and living life to the fullest and having a great time. So she's going to be talking about how she does that next week. So remember, please, to join us tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. for our interview with Alana Miles, and then next Tuesday at 7 p.m. with Mimi Kirk. And, of course, you can always catch Namaste Radio episodes on podcast if you missed the live episode. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. If you have more questions or comments about this episode or any other episode or any of Namaste Publishing's authors or speakers, please visit the spiritual community at namastepublishing.com. Thank you so much and have a wonderful evening. Be well. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.